before. Bum, bum, bum. I don't know what I'm saying as my trembling fingers touch forbidden places. Bum, bum, bum. I only know I've waited for so long for the chance that we are taking. Bum, bum, bum. I don't know and I don't care what made you tell him you don't love him anymore. Bum, bum, bum. And as I taste your tender kisses, I can tell you've never been this far before. Bum, bum, bum. And as I take the love you're giving, I can feel tension building in your mind. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum. And you're wondering if tomorrow I'll still love you like I'm loving you tonight. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum. You have no way of knowing, but tonight will only make me love you more. And I hope that you'll believe me, 'cause I know you've never been this far before. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum, bum.
Jones and Big John Talley had a big crap game going back in the alley, and I kept rolling them seven and winning all them pots. My luck was so good I could do no wrong. I just kept on rolling and controlling them bones. Finally they just threw up their hand and said, when you hot, you hot. I said, yeah.
When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
When I heard something behind me, I turned around and there was a big old cop. He said, hello, boy. Then he gave us a grin and said, look like I'm gonna have to haul y'all in and keep all that money for evidence. I said, well, son, when you hot, you hot.
He said, yeah, when you're hot, hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You can explain it all down at City Hall. I said, yeah, when you're hot, hot, you're hot. In the court, I couldn't believe my eyes. The judge was a fishing buddy that I recognized. I said, hey, judge, old buddy, old pal, I'll pay you that $100 if you get me out of this spot. So he gave my friends a little fine to pay. He turned around and grinned at me and said, 90 days, Jerry, when you hot, you hot. And I said, thanks a lot.
When you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not.
You let my friends go free and throw the book at me. He said, well, when you're hot, you're hot. I said, well, I'll tell you one thing.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. She wasn't even really sure where she was at.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, You must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Plastercaster, and I always listen to WRCT when I'm in Pittsburgh because only talented people are played on the station.
You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Live it like you want to live it. Give it like you want to give it.
The sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet, because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
We have not really talked about COVID for a while because it's become kind of background noise to so many people. Whether that's right or wrong, I'm not saying, but it has become background noise to a large share of the United States. But we're currently in the middle of a wave so massive that the real number of infections might be 500,000 infections per day already now. And you might say, well, but hold on a second, David, those aren't the official numbers right now. And you would be absolutely correct, but I'll explain. If you look at the official case numbers, you'll see that we're back up to about 100,000 cases per day. In fact, if I look at the absolute newest numbers, we're at about 99,500 cases per day. So call it 100,000 cases per day. But we're now at a point where there's just a ton of sort of like who cares around the country. And the belief is that we're capturing maybe only 1 out of 5 actual infections that we have. Now, remember, a case is you've got a positive test. An infection is someone has the virus, whether it shows up as a positive test or not. And there's a few different reasons that we are not capturing nearly all of the infections. Number one, many people are just no longer getting tested when they have symptoms. Oh, I've got symptoms. Yeah, it's probably COVID or not. I don't know, but I'm just staying home. Or maybe I'm not even staying home if you're less responsible or unable to. But that's an infection and it's not showing up as a case. That's first and foremost. Number two, we have a ton of people getting home tests. And these home tests, there's nothing magical. There's no Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or RFID in your home test. If you test positive on a home test and you don't report it anywhere, that also doesn't show up in the case numbers, even though it's an infection. And then thirdly, there's essentially no more testing of asymptomatic people going on. Very sparingly, there are places that are doing surveillance testing, meaning everybody gets tested on some period of time. Friends of mine and family who work in academic settings, some of them say, yeah, we get tested once a week or twice a week, just to keep the campus sort of in a regular testing mode, but that's basically gone away. And so asymptomatic people are essentially not showing up anywhere. And so to get the real number of infections, we have to multiply by roughly 5, says Dr. Eric Topol, who has a great Twitter on COVID stuff, and he's been a guest on this show, meaning that our 100,000 official cases per day probably means around 500,000 actual infections per day, which is just an incredible number. Now, the good news so far is that if we look at deaths, deaths continue to decline. And we typically believe there's about a 3 or 4 week delay from when cases increase before you see an increase in deaths. And it's been 2 months of increasing cases and deaths continue to decline, now down technically below the level of flu deaths in the United States, in the sense that if in the average, oh, I'm sorry, no, that's completely wrong, but I apologize. That's not true at all. We average about 100 flu deaths a day in an average flu season. And we're at about 250 COVID deaths a day. So still 2.5 times as many COVID deaths as flu deaths. But hospitalizations are going up. So it is very it's conceivable and plausible that soon we are going to see the death numbers go up as well. We're already seeing a 20% increase in hospitalizations. Now, in the meantime, we are learning many new things about COVID. One of those is not a good piece of news. It's that COVID is now evolving quickly enough with enough variants that are, we've had variants forever, but now the variants actually seem to slightly more regularly outcompete each other, as Dr. Eric Topol has written about. And this means that more quickly we are getting variants that can break through boosters and can break through natural immunity as well to reinfect people potentially multiple times per year. That's very, very much not good. Now, there is one bit of good news if we want to look for one, which is that we're currently in what's being colloquially called wave five, or also known as the BA4/BA5 wave. Remember, we had the original Omicron wave and then the secondary Omicron. OK, so now we're on BA4 and BA5 variants. If you look at South Africa, you see that this wave five has already leveled off and started to decline. And so oftentimes what happens in South Africa happens in the United States somewhere around, you know, 6 to 8 weeks later. And we hope that that's the case and that this is the peak. But this is these are incredible numbers, 500,000 infections believed per day. And one other element of this that's a bit concerning is we may already be kind of behind on vaccines. The Omicron tailored vaccine, which is going to be tailored to the first Omicron variant back from late November, early December 2021, that vaccine is going to be out in a couple of months. And by then, we're going to be like five variants away. So from that. So there's a real question as to whether we can even keep up or catch up when it comes to vaccination, because it takes a while to get the vaccines updated. So that's what's going on. I'd be curious to hear from you. Leave a comment, send an email, send a tweet. At this point, are you taking any COVID precautions at all? I know many people in the audience are taking full precautions, and many people in the audience are taking absolutely no precautions at this point in time, as of what I heard from you guys about a couple months ago. Let me know where you are right now. I have for you today an ultra viral video of former President George W. Bush with what is an incredible Freudian slip, wherein he says that the Iraq invasion that he led in 2003 was brutal and unjustified. And of course, that's correct, but that's not what he meant. George W. This is really unbelievable. George W. Bush was speaking at the George W. Bush Institute this week about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And during that speech, he meant to call the Russian invasion of Ukraine unjustified and brutal, which is true. But he instead said Iraq. And he just sort of like laughs it off and says, hey, I'm 75 years old now. And we're going to look at the video. It's disturbing to see one of the biggest tragedies, optional tragedies of the century so far, reduced to a whoopsie, I misspoke. So take a look at this video. 17 million views in under 24 hours so far. Likely we'll get 30, 40 million views. George W. Bush speaking about, meaning to speak about Russia, but slipping up.
In contrast, Russian elections are rigged. Political opponents are imprisoned or otherwise eliminated from participating in the electoral process. The result is an absence of checks and balances in Russia and the decision of one man to launch a wholly unjustified and brutal invasion of Iraq. I mean, of Ukraine. Iraq, too. Anyway. 75.
So he seems to say Iraq 2 there. And it's not clear if he's joking, but it's clear he didn't mean to say that. That was a slip up. He accidentally called his invasion of Iraq in 2003 brutal and unjustified, and he laughs it off. Now, there are people in the audience who are young enough that you may not remember the entire lead up to the Iraq War or maybe even know that much about it. This was an absolute tragedy based on false information linking Iraq to the 9/11 attacks and claiming Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, which we can't ever say with certitude that they didn't have, but that were never found, we can say. 4,400 U.S. armed forces were killed in that optional, misguided war. 32,000 American troops were wounded in action in that war. 318 coalition forces were killed. 16,000 Iraqi military and police were killed. Somewhere around 26, 27,000 Iraqi insurgents were killed. 136 journalists and media worker, another 50 media workers were killed on duty covering that war. And population-based studies of Iraq suggest that the civilian casualties were somewhere between, and I know this is a big range, civilian casualties in Iraq during the Iraq War were between 150,000 and a million excess deaths. Think about those numbers. Think about the incredible loss of life based on what were the things that were being said at the time. At the time, there were three main lies that were being told, which many Americans fell for, particularly Fox News viewers. We covered this when the show started. The war was still going on. It wasn't the beginning of it, but it was still going on. The lie was told that Saddam had something to do with 9/11. He didn't. The lie was told that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. If they had them, they were never found. And the lie was told that the world community was generally supportive of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. The world community was not supportive of that. And on that lie, and on a false intelligence case made by Colin Powell, made by Condoleezza Rice and the Bush administration at large, somewhere between, you know, all told, 200,000 and 1.1, 1.2 million people died. Untold amounts of money was spent. And for those in our audience too young to remember the lead up, it was really it was the first time I saw firsthand and experienced in a way that I could sort of remember and understand it. You know, during the first Gulf War, I was a little kid in the early 90s, and I remember seeing, on TV, my parents were watching footage of what was going on, but I didn't really understand it. In 2003, I saw the drumbeat. We've got to go. We're going to have to go. Saddam's a bad guy. Yellow cake uranium. Colin Powell making the case using bad information. And then we're going to be greeted as liberators. And Dick Cheney saying they're going to throw roses at us, I think he said. And of course, it didn't happen. And it was an absolute and total disaster. So George W. Bush, you know, you can analyze this a bunch of different ways. Oh, he's 75. He's kind of losing it. He doesn't know what he's saying. Or it was a very meaningful Freudian slip where he maybe now recognizes the misguided nature of that invasion. My sense is, I mean, listen, I don't like rewriting history and making George Bush out to be anything better than what he was, which was a disaster on basically every front. But in some way, with the benefit of hindsight, I think if you got Bush in a room where there was no media and he was just totally honest with you, my sense is he probably would express regrets about Iraq. I'm not saying that it would be a complete 180, but I think to some degree he realizes that it was not worth it and that it was wrong. I don't know that he would ever say it. I'm speculating. And I would like to believe that that Freudian slip was in some way representative of what he actually believes. Let me know what you think. Incredible video. Monday, Memorial Day, we are doing a big membership blowout. It'll be a one-day discount. We want to bring in as many new people into the ranks of membership as we can as we lead up to the midterm elections of 2022, significant midterm elections. If you would like to get the coupon code to sign up on Memorial Day, just get on my newsletter at davidpakman.com. In the immediate aftermath of this horrible terrorist shooting incident in Buffalo, New York, over the weekend, we talked about it Monday, we talked about it Tuesday. This was an individual, a white 18-year-old, domestically born American, who was specifically targeting black people, influenced by right-wing ideas regularly parroted out on Fox News, including of the white replacement theory or great replacement theory, white birth rates and other things. In the immediate aftermath of that, I already told you that there was a segment on Fox News where they did their normal dog and pony show where they talk about violence in video games as possibly a cause for this shooting. We've also seen the promulgators of the exact same ideology that the shooter cites in his manifesto. People like Tucker Carlson and others say this was just a lone incident of mental illness. That's all it was. There's no politics here. There's no ideology. There's no conservatism or liberalism. And we also saw Ben Shapiro say, if there is politics here, it really sounds more like wokeness than anything else, which is, of course, completely untrue. The ideas in the manifesto are being espoused exclusively by right-wing political commentators. Well, let me now show you some other attempts to shift and place blame in absurd and pathetic ways happening on Fox News. Jesse Waters pulls out. It's sort of like, it's kind of like pulling random reasons out of a hat, a MAGA hat, I guess we could say. Lockdowns, forced masking, and woke ideology are what Jesse Waters says really we should be looking at as the causes of the Buffalo shooting. Take a look at this. This is from yesterday.
We have a crisis right now. The American public education system is hurting our kids. Math and reading rates are plummeting. Studies are showing that kids are talking less. They're already warning about a third of elementary school students need, quote, intensive support. But our leaders don't care. They're more concerned about how they're going to force masks back on kids. Some school districts in California and New Jersey have just implemented fresh mask mandates in classrooms this week. We're setting these kids up for failure, for a generation deep in a mental health crisis after lockdowns, forced masking, woke ideology. Kids are feeling depressed. Just look at what happened in the Buffalo situation.
What?
A teenager whose school system failed him decided his only option was to turn to the dark web, where he was radicalized. A failed education system let that happen. But the so-called experts think they haven't done anything wrong. Watch.
So has Jesse Waters seen the Tucker Carlson show? Because if so, he'd know exactly what inspired the shooter. The shooter's manifesto verbatim has talking points from Tucker Carlson's show in it. Masking? What? What? And Jesse Waters brings up fair and concerning things. It is true that COVID era babies, many of them now toddlers, seem to have something going on in terms of language development. I've read that. That's concerning. We've got to deal with that. But the shooter's 18. Okay. The shooter was 16 when COVID started. And the idea that that's what left the shooter no choice but to go out and target black people, even if it were the case that you had limited language development due to masking, doesn't make you go and target black people. It's a completely absurd claim, and they don't know what to do. They don't know what to say because their ideology is verbatim in the manifesto. Now, by the way, constant mass shootings also aren't happening in any other advanced country where they had masking and by sort of like, what we call normal schooling, where you learn empiricism and science and stuff like that. They call it woke schooling. They have it in other countries as well, and they don't have the mass shooting problem. One thing they don't have is ready access to so many guns. The party of personal responsibility, as you can see, blaming the left for making this guy murder innocent people. This guy is a complete and total joke. Now, here's another example. This one's also from Fox News. This is Kennedy, Lisa Kennedy. She links abortion and the sort of disregard for human life that she says is implicit in abortion to shooting. She says, when we disregard human life, of course you get shootings. Wild stuff.
Just not. And I know a lot of people, a lot of Democrats who say, I am pro-choice, but I don't believe that we should be killing babies after 15 weeks. I certainly don't think that we should be performing these procedures and celebrating them at 20 weeks. You have a lot of Democrats saying, you know, we used to hear safe, legal, and rare.
Yes.
You don't hear that anymore. You hear people chanting about how great abortion is, regardless of how you feel about whether or not the courts or Congress should be involved. That is not something to be celebrated. And we have lost the plot as a society. So don't be surprised when there are mass casualty events at the hands of sociopaths when we have so little regard for human life. And that starts with basic, decent conversations where we have mutual dignity and curiosity. We have to find a way to get back to that place even when we disagree vehemently.
So you think that people who seek abortions are sociopaths?
No, I'm saying that mass shooters are sociopaths. Mass shooters and people like that are raised to have very little respect for human life. And I think we have to get back to a place in society where we do have respect for each other, where you don't have people going on the subway and shooting people and trying.
Okay, so it's a very, very dumb show. But her argument is mass shooters don't have respect for life and for society. And people who gleefully get abortions, as she claims people do, don't have respect for life and society. And so the link is, in general, when you don't have respect for life and society, you either go and get abortions or you go and do a mass shooting. It's hard to imagine a dumber take. It truly is. But they are desperate to blame anything they can other than looking inward. And I get it. It's hard to look inward when the blame is on you. And again, we're not saying legal blame, but what we are saying is the ideology espoused by the Shooter's Manifesto is an ideology that has been nurtured and incubated in right wing media. And Fox News is part of it. Whether Kennedy herself talked about white replacement theory or not, I don't know. Maybe she didn't. But at this point, there's no way that she could not realize that many of the people on her network are the ones pushing the same stuff that was in the manifesto. You look everywhere else. Abortion's the reason, or masking, or woke education, or whatever the case may be. They're not going to look inward. But we have to remember that we know exactly why the shooter did what they did. Hey, this is very, very interesting. I finally was able to get on Truth Social. Truth Social is the Trumpian social media platform that Trump seems unable to pronounce correctly.
Truth Central.
Exactly. Truth Central. I finally was able to get on Truth Social because they now you can just sign up on a desktop computer. You don't need to have a particular phone now to do it. So you can find me on Truth Social at @dpacman. I'm just trolling on there. I'll probably get banned. But I realized when looking around that on Election Day, Tuesday, before and after the election, failed former President Donald Trump was engaged in just a dystopian, authoritarian series of screeds and posts. I don't know what they don't call them tweets because it's not Twitter, although they basically copied Twitter to design this site. Check out the stuff that Donald Trump was posting throughout the day and then after. So Trump posting, remember, all three candidates in Pennsylvania were ultra MAGA. So what Trump was doing there was hedging his endorsement. Trump endorsed Mehmet Oz, and we still don't know who actually won that primary. But Trump was trying to basically say whether it's Dave McCormick or Kathy Barnett or Mehmet Oz, it's all a win for Trump because they're all ultra MAGA. So that was Trump hedging earlier in the day. But then here's the really scary post. As has happened before in other elections, including with Donald Trump's in 2020, we didn't have the results around 11 p.m. or midnight Eastern on Election Day. And Donald Trump posted to Truth Central, quote, Dr. Oz should declare victory. It makes it much harder for them to cheat with the ballots that they, quote, just happened to find. End Trump's quote and end full quote. That's an authoritarian nightmare. And that is exactly, you know, when we go back to Trump coming out at 2 a.m. on Election Day in November of 2020 and saying we won when he very clearly hadn't won. It wasn't clear he lost, but it was very clear he hadn't yet won. He's admitting what the game is here. You say you won. You just take credit for it. And it makes it harder then. And it poisons the well where people say, I don't know. I mean, he claimed victory. He must have won. Trump then attacking Fox News, saying Fox News had a really bad night. They were way off on the count and timing in the Oz vote. Anybody watching would have said it was over when actually it was just the opposite. I assume the coverage was being led by the same guy that called Arizona, who, believe it or not, they brought back. I want his agent. Now, of course, Trump continues to insist that he actually won Arizona. It is not true. Joe Biden won Arizona. Joe Biden won Arizona by any measure of how you count ballots. And Trump continues to lie about that. And then Trump posting another one of these truths, which are actually lies, quite Kafkaesque. Quote, the fake news media is having a really hard time saying that MAGA and Trump didn't have anything but a spectacular evening of voting and winning. Hold on. The best is yet to come. Now, of course, Madison Cawthorn lost after just 16 months in office. Some Trumpists won, some Trumpists lost. But understand that the game is endorse mostly people who we know are going to win with or without Trump's endorsement and then take credit for it. It is a nightmare on Truth Social. If you're curious, it's sort of masochistic. I get it. But if you're curious, I'm on there at least until they ban me. I'm Dee Pacman on Truth Troth.
Troth Central.
Yeah, exactly. We'll take a quick break and be right back after this. Today, we're going to be speaking with Professor Baruch Fischoff, who is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, where he studies how experts and non-experts think about risks. It's really great to have you on. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, thanks for having me, David.
So risk is a very interesting topic because much like this is a bad analogy, but much like when we come across a yellow light when driving and we are intuitively making a number of calculations that make us decide to either go through the light or not, we are thinking about the risks to us of all sorts of different activities all the time. And the first part I think maybe that would make sense to start with is, are human intuitions about risk generally reliable or not so much, where we have to sometimes step back and say, am I actually evaluating this risk correctly?
Well, we're generally pretty good, particularly where we have good sources of information or we have the same risk, see the same risk time and again, have a chance for trial and error. But when something is new and we don't have unreliable sources, then we can, we can be in trouble. So I would say, for example, Pittsburgh has a driving culture where people run the Reds. And yep. I grew up in Detroit where drivers are much more disciplined. So if I have well-tuned intuitions for Detroit driving. Took me a while to get right to adjust them for Pittsburgh driving.
So one line that's often repeated for people who are afraid of flying on commercial aviation is, you know, it's really safe. It's actually more dangerous to drive to the airport statistically than the flight itself. And then when you investigate that, you find out that, well, yes, that's true in a way. But what it's looking at is based on passenger miles. And because airplanes are much faster than cars, you're traveling many more miles. And maybe it's true, but the risk difference is not as big as some might say. With something like that, How is the average human to use that to assess, is flying safe enough for me? Because most of us don't think about, well, what's my risk of dying per 1,000 miles driven? We just sort of have a sense of, do I know people who have died in car accidents? Could I get into a car accident and survive? And most of us make the decision that we're willing to drive around. But are those comparisons useful?
Not really. I think just for the reason that you cited is that often people who give us those comparative risk statistics are really, they're trying to work us. They're trying to get us to do something like fly or drive or, you know, wear a mask or wash our hands or whatever. It's often difficult to find statistics that are just presented in a trustworthy way, that aren't slanted, that are really relevant to our decisions. And in a situation like that, we depend on people to do that work for us. I saw a report this morning about, so one of the things that I wear a mask still. And this is May 19th, 2022. And that's because I think there's a lot of uncertainty about long COVID. Mm-hmm. And there was a long report, I think by well-meaning people, with a long report in one of our major newspapers about a study showing that long COVID is very common among relatively young people. But what they didn't tell us is, well, how good is the measurement of long COVID? Are the observations for people who've gotten it from Omicron or the earlier variants where the problems were much greater? And then how many people did they have in each group? Like in the data set that they had, there were relatively few people over 65. But that seems to be because they just didn't have a lot of observations from people over 65. So it didn't answer my question. What's the chance of my getting long COVID if I, if I'm exposed? And it certainly didn't answer the question of, well, if I get long COVID, what's the chance I'm going to give it and get COVID, long COVID, I'm going to give it to my wife or to, you know, or to somebody else. So that's what we really count on the experts to work up the data in an honest way for us. And it turned out to be, it requires some skill.
Also, presenting the data in a way that it's sort of useful to people seems like it's a skill as well. I recently read, whether this is accurate or not, it doesn't really matter, but I recently read that for someone without pre-existing conditions, the risk of dying from COVID is the same as dying in a car accident for 10,000 miles driven. And I was thinking to myself, is that high or low? I don't really know what that is. It's sort of a strange comparison to make. How do I even evaluate that?
Yeah. And in addition, you're making your risks and benefits are different in the two situations. You get some benefit from taking a long trip. You have a different set of benefits from making a statement or having to fight to be the person who's wearing a mask. So you really want some, what you would really would like is somebody just to give you the numbers to say, you know, if you take this trip, you have one chance. On an average car trip, I think you have about one chance in 10 million of being in a fatal accident. And the risk is even smaller if you're not drinking or driving early Sunday morning. So give me the numbers. People can handle those numbers and let me decide. Don't try to work me.
Can you talk a little bit about when we measure risk, the difference between absolute and relative risks?
Right. So something can double your risk of something terrible happening to you. But it makes a big difference whether that takes it from 1 in 1 million to 2 in 1 million or from 1 in 100 to 2 in 100. So you really need the absolute numbers, the absolute risk numbers, in order to make the risk benefit trade-offs, because you're trading absolute benefits against absolute risk. So those relative risks are really meaningless. They're often misleading.
So one example would be in medical science reporting, we often will read that a certain food, for example, might increase the risk or decrease the risk of, say, a type of cancer by 40%. And that's a very big number, 40%. But what you're saying is it might be the difference between a lifetime risk of 1% and 1.4%. And we need to have that information to really accurately assess what it means.
Yeah, exactly. I have some friends, colleagues at Dartmouth Medical School who have developed a drug fact box, like the nutrition fact box, that shows you the probability of things going right and going wrong if you take different drugs and absolute statistics. And that's information that's even hard for doctors to know. So one of their examples is a sleeping pill, and that you find that people who take the sleeping pill fall asleep in 37 minutes compared to people who don't take the sleeping pill fall asleep on average in 45 minutes. And then they tell you what are the, in absolute numbers, what are the side effects with and without the scene. Well, that's what you need to know. And you and I might make a difference. Those 8 minutes might mean a lot to me and not a lot to you relative to the side effects.
One of the recent ones, speaking of medications and side effects, has been around COVID vaccines, where there seem to be some strange risks. I call them strange. I'll see if you agree. Strange risk assessments when it comes to risks of the vaccine, specifically as compared to risks of COVID. So, for example, when you considered at one point myocarditis was one topic that that was quite present. And there was a lot of talk of the risk of myocarditis from the vaccine. And absent from many of those conversations was the relatively higher risk of myocarditis from COVID. And very often it seemed like the consideration people were making was, what's my risk of myocarditis from the vaccine versus zero, when really it should be compared to the risk from myocarditis from COVID, should it not?
Oh, exactly. And it is a persistent puzzle why people who are, you know, very dedicated to our public health, people who are very dedicated to our health and our safety, and why they don't know that. And I think it's, I mean, I have a lot of respect for public health people. They're dedicated. They're often brave. They expose themselves. They work long hours.
Yeah.
But I think they lack three. They get into these problems, three things. One is they don't know how to do risk analysis. The second is that their inclination is to tell people what to do rather than to empower people to make their own decisions. And the third is they never test their messages. And if you think we've got a, you know, wonderfully heterogeneous country where people have different backgrounds and different desires, you can't imagine, a technical expert can't assume that what makes sense to them will make sense to the people that they're talking to. And it is easy to test your messages. Like, draft a message, let a few diverse people look at the message, read it aloud, tell you whatever comes into their mind. And you're always surprised by things you thought were clear that confuse them, things that didn't confuse them, but they misinterpreted, things that you forgot to say that you thought were common knowledge, and things about your tone that they found disrespectful, where you thought was, I thought it was fine, but you ticked them off. So it's easy to test messages. They rarely do it.
One of the things that relates to risk assessments, I'm reminded of when years ago I read the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, and he talks about a lot of cognitive biases and heuristics that affect our thinking about things. And some of them that seem very relevant to risk assessment would be, for example, framing things as the possibilities of losses versus the possibilities of gains. He did some very interesting work wherein he would sort of set up like lottery type experiments where in some there's a probability of a gain, in others a probability of a loss. But the expected values, just thinking mathematically of these scenarios, were absolutely identical. In principle, humans rationally thinking should be indifferent between these scenarios. But we found out that framing things as losses versus gains had a major impact on people's willingness to take risks in sort of gambling type situations. Can you talk a little bit about real world scenarios, not imaginary lotteries, but real world scenarios where that cognitive bias has a real impact in people's decisions?
Yeah, so Danny Kahneman was one of my doctoral advisors.
Oh, no way.
Along with Amos Tversky, his late.
Yeah.
I even have a cameo role in that.
Wow.
In the book. So one thing to know about the kind of research that psychologists do is we look at situations where people have not figured out what to do. And those are situations that, from a scientific perspective, are revealing a fundamental thought cognitive processes, emotional processes, where in everyday life, those situations can be fairly rare. That is, you've learned what to do by trial and error. Somebody you trust has told you what to do. You've watched what other people do, and they seem to be getting along with things, and so on. So our research tends to accentuate the negative because we look for problems, and because that's just the way our science goes. Think of situations like the pandemic. Put us in situations where we don't really know where these kinds of biases or framing effects are most effective, because we don't really know what to do. We don't really know who to trust. People we talk to have all sorts of different ideas. And, you know, one bit of advice is to talk to different people, and none of them may know the right answer. But they have different ways of looking at the problem, and you can decide, well, what way do I want to frame it? Do I want to be thinking about this as a loss or a gain? Another thing, a bit of advice, I think, like that the literature would, I think, support is don't beat yourself up too much.
Mm.
These are legitimately difficult decisions, partly because they're novel and the stakes are high, but partly because the experts have failed us. They haven't given us statistics that they want. They've manipulated the statistics, as you suggested earlier. So we're really, sort of on our own. So find somebody, people you trust. Run it by a few other people. If you've done the best you can, then things don't work out. Don't add the insult of regret to the injury that you've already suffered.
One really difficult area when it comes to taking a risk assessment and making policy and economic decisions is really unlikely events with an absolutely catastrophic impact, where our standard expected value type calculations might not be very informative. One such would be, the number that's often stated is the odds of a meteor with at least a 1 kilometer diameter hitting Earth is basically 1 every 500,000 years is when we would expect it. Now, that could be in 2 years, although maybe astronomy is good enough that we would know if it would be in two years. But in theory, it could be in 2 years or it could be in 499,998 years. So in such a situation where it's a very low likelihood, but absolutely catastrophic, it can be difficult to know how much money should be invested in technology to save us from that. How much should we invest in the technology that would allow us to redirect or blow up such a meteor? How can humans think about things on that scale? So catastrophic, but so unlikely.
I mean, one thing to ask is, what would we get for our money?
Sure.
Great ideas for what to do about it, then it's a poor investment. And in our own lives, if we can't do anything about it, why worry about it? So sometimes it pays to worry about relatively small risks if we can do something to reduce them, or can put ourselves in a situation where we're feel like, I've done everything I could, and I'm just going to hope for the best.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the difficulty is, again, when we start to get to such large numbers, it's sort of like thinking about a billion years ago. And that's very hard for most, the scale of some of these things is hard for the average human to sort of think of, or, $1 trillion. What does that really mean relative to the average annual budget? If you were to shrink it down, there's probably some very small risk when anyone drives a car. Not of a car accident, but I'm talking about a mechanical failure that undetected would almost certainly explode your car. And you could make the decision to check that thing every time you drive, but none of us really do because we've assessed the risk is so small. Is that a better example to think through how we would evaluate whether action or inaction is the right path?
Yeah, if there's nothing you can do, don't worry about it. So I recently saw advice that if you're really worried about leaving the gas on, take a picture of your burners before you leave the house.
Mm.
So there's something you can do. It doesn't change the risk in case they were a little ajar, but it does put your mind at ease. With modern cars, you can't really look under the hood and figure out whether anything is going wrong. You would be fortunate if you're in a state like Pennsylvania that has mandatory safety checks every year. And we've been here 35 years, and every few years they find something, that we wouldn't have known otherwise. So there's a place where I think government coercion, as some people would call it, has served us well.
Very interesting. We've been speaking with Professor Baruch Fischoff, who teaches at Carnegie Mellon University. Really appreciate your time and your insights today.
Oh, thanks for the conversation.
Let's talk about a new movement within the Republican Party. And the question at the end that I want to come back to is this a net good or a net bad for the United States of America? So Madison Cawthorn, radical Trumpist Republican congressman, Madison Cawthorn, after just 16 months in office, is already on his way out. He will be leaving in January. He lost his primary to a challenger in North Carolina on Tuesday. And at least part of the reason that Madison Cawthorn lost is that he became the focus or the target of what we might call establishment Republicans. Madison Cawthorn has had a bunch of run-ins with the law, a couple of very high speed speeding and potentially reckless driving incidents involving his vehicle. Three times caught bringing a firearm, trying to bring firearms through TSA security and bringing a gun to a school. I'm sorry, a knife to a school council meeting of some kind, and then saying that he gets invited to cocaine fueled orgies by other members of Congress. And it became very clear that the Republican Party establishment decided we're going after this guy, and they succeeded. The group that released some of the controversial videos of Madison Cawthorn say that they are going to be targeting radical Trumpist lunatic Congresswoman Lauren Boebert next. Business Insider reporting Madison Cawthorn foes who targeted him with a damaging nude video say Lauren Boebert is next on their hit list. The group that posted a viral, sexually explicit video of a nude Congressman Madison Cawthorn with another man in bed is now focusing on Colorado Representative Lauren Boebert for its next takedown, Insider has learned. David Wheeler, who's the co-founder of the American Muckrakers PAC, said to Insider, quote, I think we're going to go after Lauren Boebert in Colorado in a similar way. I think we're going to engage in that race pretty quickly. Wheeler is a Democrat. His co-founder is unaffiliated. The group has Republicans among its advisors. Wheeler said he's received interesting information about the Republican firebrand Boebert, whose primary against Republican State Senator Don Quorum is on June 28. The information is, quote, certainly not as salacious as some of the Cawthorn stuff. It deals instead with financial matters, and he didn't yet disclose more of it. A spokesperson for Boebert did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Now, as the article points out, previously, Lauren Boebert has also had issues when it comes to campaign finance. Last year, the AP reported that Boebert failed to disclose her husband's income during the campaign. In violation of ethics and campaign finance laws, she revealed her husband made nearly $1 million in 2019 and 2020 as a consultant for an energy firm. So what's the question that we have to ask here? Is this good or bad for the country? And what do I mean by that? Well, it's abundantly clear that there are far less crazy Republicans out there, and that as a general thing, replacing a crazy Republican with a less crazy Republican is good in a sense. But at the same time, if the less crazy Republicans can get things done versus these wild Trumpists who say a lot of wacky things but don't get anything done and sometimes even get kicked off of committees, is the country better off with the crazier Republicans in office? I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a good example. Marjorie Taylor Greene was stripped of her committee assignments and essentially has no influence in the House of Representatives. I mean, OK, you could find some areas around the fringes where maybe she is influencing someone, but very, very little. Matt Gaetz has some influence, but also he's kind of a laughingstock. If you replace those people with, you know, hardworking, kind of buttoned up Republicans, if you replace them with people like Mitt Romney, who would certainly get fewer headlines, but might be more effective at getting legislation passed or whipping votes or whatever the case may be, is the country better off or not? Obviously, when you take a very wide view and you say, well, listen, if you take eight outrageous lunatic Republicans and replace them with people with whom, you know, we disagree on taxes and abortion, but they're not out of their minds, it sounds like that's an improvement. But at the same time, if they can actually accomplish things, maybe it's better to have the wackier people in office. I want to hear from you. And, you know, this is also a conversation which we may be having in the context of 2024, because we talk about DeSantis versus Trump. If they both were to run for the Republican nomination in 24, DeSantis is almost as crazy as Trump, but he's far more competent. And so in reality, are we better off with Trump, even though he's more of a global laughingstock? I don't know. This is a prediction. It's a guess. It's an estimate. It's not something we can say for sure in advance. But I want to hear from you about it. Let me know your thoughts. They are continuing to attack Dr. Anthony Fauci. They want to see him in prison. Many of them do. For what crime? We don't really know. And the latest is that Donald Trump's former economic advisor, Peter Navarro, says that he will force Fauci to admit that he created COVID. Now, how that, if it's the China virus, as they say, and China created it, how is it that Fauci created it? It doesn't really make sense. We're going to look at this clip and consider how extreme, how dangerous, how disturbing it is that they want to go after medical doctors who just give us their best advice at the time. These are sick people. Here's Peter Navarro on Newsmax. Listen to this.
Here's your future, Tony. Republicans are going to sweep and take the House back from Nancy Pelosi. And as soon as that happens, you're going to sit your ass down in a chair in Congress and you're going to confess to creating the virus that's killed almost a million Americans now, all on your watch, sir. And then we're going to figure
out. He's talking about Fauci again, just as a reminder.
All the special deals you had with all those grant money things. And we're going to fit you for an orange jumpsuit, Tony. You can count on that. So don't be smug on CNN, dude. Here's your
OK, so this is all a reaction to a comment that Dr. Fauci recently made. Dr. Fauci was asked, you know, he served under Donald Trump. He was made chief medical advisor under Joe Biden. And he was asked, if Trump comes back in 2024, would you serve under Trump? And Fauci essentially said no. Now, I actually think that it's sort of a non-question. Anthony Fauci is now, what is he? Is he 81? He's 81 years old. If and when Trump comes back, he would be close to 85 years old. I anticipate that Dr. Fauci is going to be retiring in the next few years. So at the end of the day, I don't really believe it's even a choice Dr. Fauci would be making. Will I or won't I stay under Donald Trump? I could be wrong. But it is to some degree a political statement. I mean, Dr. Fauci is saying it was so crazy trying to deal with COVID under Trump that if Trump comes back, I'm out. That's fine. Why is the right obsessed with going after medical doctors? Well, one of the answers is their political ideology that they espouse since the start of the pandemic. Be very skeptical of vaccines, be skeptical of masks, be skeptical of whether staying away from people physically even really prevents the spread of the virus, being skeptical about the fact that this is much more deadly than the flu, all of these different things. All of the political position, all of the medical positions that they staked out were not really medical positions. They weren't really science-based positions. They were political positions made to perpetuate their own ideology of so-called freedom and all these different things, and to make Donald Trump's failed response look less bad or to even look good, if you can imagine it. And so when that's the political position that you stake out, you have to make those who have a different view your enemies. And the medical science community had a different view. The medical science community had views that differed about guidelines, safety guidelines, vaccines, masking, all these different things. And so you have to make them your enemies. And that is it's a feature rather than a bug of modern reactionary politics. It's not just, you know, we kind of have like a different perspective about the correct level of taxes or whatever the case may be, which is like, okay, well, we can disagree, but it's not as, I mean, I would argue it's pretty clear what is better economically when it comes to taxes. But there is more of like an ideology associated with it and the spirit of what the government should be doing in terms of taxation. OK, with a lot of these COVID related things, it's just the science. That's all it is. And when you are basing your politics on reactionary fear mongering and arguing that those with a different view are evil and on and on and on, when that's your perspective, you have to attack everybody and make everybody your enemy. And so doctors become your enemy. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Now, I want to go back to the obvious hypocrisy. Trump called it the China virus. China did it. China created it. But at the same time, they want to blame Dr. Fauci. It seems like hypocrisy. But remember, hypocrisy has no bottom or no top, I guess, depending on your perspective with the modern right wing. So what will they come up with? I am sure that they will say, well, no, Fauci had and funded China creating it. That's how they will square the two. Peter Navarro really makes MyPillow Mike Lindell seem like kind of a reasonable guy. He makes him seem almost sane. And the really scary part is that the rhetoric is becoming more overtly violent. Even now talking about imprisoning or going after medical doctors, and they're doing it all out in the open. It's becoming normal. it's extraordinarily unsettling how comfortable the modern American right is with threats of violence, threats of suspending due process, and just jail people. Just put them in jail. Very, very scary stuff. We have a voicemail number, and that number is 2192-DAVID-P. I did this story yesterday about how Jordan Peterson attacked me for a video I did about him. I got a voicemail about that. Let's listen to the voicemail, then we'll talk about it.
Hey, David. Dale from Denver again. Just calling regarding the Jordan Peterson clip you put on YouTube.
Yes.
The question I would ask Dr. Peterson is, you think it's bad to demoralize them and by telling them the truth and the reality of what's going on? But is that actually better to lie to them about that than it is to tell them the truth so they can face the truth and maybe come up with a solution?
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is basically the point I made. Jordan Peterson wept because he felt today's youth are being demoralized and their lives are being ruined by being told, as humans, we're up against some hard problems. And one of those problems is climate change caused by industrialization, burning of fossil fuels, and human activity on planet Earth. Jordan Peterson says it's demoralizing to tell young people that, and they're almost being told, Peterson claims, that they are morally bad because these are problems that we're facing. My view is it would be immoral not to tell them that. If we want to solve these problems, to some degree, young people are going to be the people that, when they are not so young, are going to be in a position, hopefully, to solve some of the problems that we're dealing with. If we hide the fact that these problems exist from them, how are we doing them a service? We're doing them a disservice, I would argue. And that's, I believe that's what the caller is arguing here as well. I agree with the caller. I disagree with Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson, as I told you yesterday, after flipping out on me, said that an overweight woman is ugly and then quit Twitter. So it was a wild week on Twitter for Jordan Peterson. We have a great bonus show for you today. Here's a fascinating study that was done. Americans who do not currently have student loan debt were asked, do you support Joe Biden forgiving the student debt of people who do have debt? And overwhelmingly, those without student debt said, yes, I still am in favor of that. I don't have student debt and I'm in favor of it. And I'll explain to you why on the bonus show. Secondly, U.S. soccer has agreed to an equal pay deal for the men's and women's players. Very interesting. We'll talk about it. And there's a lot to discuss related to it. And for those of you who remember Martin Shkreli is this sort of a dark figure who is mostly known for buying a pharmaceutical company and then exploding the cost of the drug that the pharmaceutical company manufactures. He actually was just released from prison, not related to that, but related to some financial crimes that he was convicted of. He has now been released from prison, and we will talk about the hero's welcome that he's getting in some places, not everywhere, though. All of those stories on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get instant access. And remember that on Monday, Memorial Day, we'll be doing a one-day membership special, trying to bring in as many new members in one day as we can. If you'd like to be notified when that membership discount is live, just sign up for my newsletter. The newsletter is free at davidpacman.com, and you'll hear from me on Memorial Day with very specific instructions. And of course, everybody who signs up gets access to the bonus show.
Oh, the bonus show where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
Right. Okay, we'll see everybody.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
RCT, the insane from way out.
Yeah.
concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Look, we've seen the mass shootings in Charleston, South Carolina, El Paso, Texas, and Pittsburgh. Last year in Atlanta, this week in Dallas, Texas, and now in Buffalo, New York. White supremacy is a poison. It's a poison running through. It really is.
As funerals begin in Buffalo for the 10 African Americans killed by a white supremacist, we speak to Amy Spitalnik, who's been described as a 21st century Nazi hunter. She successfully sued white supremacist organizers of the deadly 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. Plus, we speak to former Buffalo mayoral candidate India Walton.
If we're going to begin to heal as a country and really beat back what is systemic racism that causes these extremist ideas and homegrown terrorists, our people have been terrorized for generations in this country. Our existence in this country comes from a place of terror.
Then we look at the fight for reproductive rights as Oklahoma lawmakers approve the most sweeping abortion ban in the country. We'll speak to The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent, Amy Littlefield, about Oklahoma and the fight for abortion after Roe Falls.
With this total abortion ban, I think Oklahoma is really becoming a harbinger of what we're going to see across huge regions of this country in the coming weeks and months when entire regions start to go dark in terms of abortion access.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States Senate has approved a $40 billion aid package for Ukraine, promising heavy weapons for its military and humanitarian aid for millions of people displaced by Russia's invasion. Democrats were unanimous in their support for the measure. Just 11 Republicans voted against it. It's by far the largest U.S. foreign aid package in decades and brings total U.S. assistance to Ukraine to $54 billion in less than 3 months. The bill's speedy passage through Congress came as Republican senators continue to block $10 billion in additional COVID funding, and as much of President Biden's legislative agenda remains stalled on Capitol Hill, including bills on voting rights and the climate crisis. In Ukraine, President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked the U.S. for its support Thursday. He said Russia's assault has completely destroyed the eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, the New York Times has published witness testimony and video showing how Russian paratroopers executed at least 8 Ukrainian men in a Kyiv suburb on March 4th in a potential war crime. Russia's rejected a call by the United Nations to end its Black Sea naval blockade, which has prevented Ukraine from exporting grain to world markets. On Thursday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the Security Council Russia's invasion threatens to trigger years of mass hunger and famine, compounding food shortages caused by climate change, COVID, and inequality.
The war in Ukraine is now adding a frightening new dimension to this picture of global hunger. Russia's invasion of its neighbor has effectively ended its food exports. Price increases of up to 30% for staple foods threaten people in countries across Africa and the Middle East, including Cameroon, Libya, Somalia.